On behalf of the congregation of University Temple, I'd like to welcome all of you tonight. I'm Reverend Sharon Moe. I'm one of the pastoral staff here at University Temple. For me, it's a great evening because we are in the midst of a time in our country and in our world that is one of, in my opinion, great danger and great fear. In this country, in Iraq, and in the rest of the world, it's a time of increasingly inflammatory American war rhetoric, of what I feel is a great sea change in our military and nuclear policies, and of an increasingly entrenched militarism that's unable to imagine making peace without waging war. But it's also a time of great courage and commitment on the part of people like Dr. von Spanek and of people like all of you. So many of you have come here tonight to hear Dr. von Spanek because you believe that the way to peace is not through waging war, but rather through collaborative justice making around the world. So many of you are involved and committed to this justice making work in a wide variety of ways. I believe that the fact that we have not declared war yet on Iraq is due in significant measure to people like you and to the work that you are doing. Many of you are here as well to listen and to learn, to listen to the perspective and the information that Dr. von Spanek is bringing, a perspective that's rooted in his own experience and relationships, and to listen to information that is both credible and reliable, not to mention insightful and wise. I believe what Dr. von Spanek shares with us tonight will be important to our continued work in deterring war and in ending the sanctions that are making life hell for so many people. And so it is with great gratitude that I welcome Hans von Spanek this evening, and that I welcome all of you and thank you for coming here tonight, as well as thank all of those persons who have made this event possible this evening. Now I'd like to introduce Alice Wolt, the Acting Executive Director of the Church Council of Greater Seattle, who is going to introduce Hans von Spanek.
Thank you and good evening. It's great to see the number of people that are here tonight that are interested in this issue and in what this country is facing. The kind of saber rattling that's going on in this country, it's good to have a person of reason amongst us and a person who is so knowledgeable about the area of the world that this country is considering making war against. Hans von Spanek comes to us very, very well equipped to tell us about that part of the world. He has spent 30 years working for the UN in a variety of positions and was the second person to resign from the position of coordinator of the Oil for Food program in Iraq that the UN was trying to manage. It is because he is a person of such integrity that he resigned and has devoted his time and his efforts to seeing that the issues in Iraq are resolved in a peaceful and in a way that will benefit the people of that country and not to be vindictive and revengeful, which seems to be the course of action that our country is on. If you did not see the article in last Sunday's Seattle Times, I would recommend it to you. He is quoted in the article. He has just recently returned from Iraq after being there a couple of weeks, and so he comes with absolutely recent news from that country. And in a world that seems to have to be suffering from amnesia, it is good for all of us to remember. And for those of us who feel somewhat hopeless at times, it's good to hear from a voice who brings us hope. Dr. von Sponeck.
Good evening, and I hope you can hear me well in the back also. Is that my assumption correct? Can you hear me? Good. No. I don't want to get closer to the mic. Is it better now? Yes? Okay, if I see you sleeping in the back, I know it's not so good, but I always feel endangered. It reminds me of a military projectile here, and so I want to keep my distance. But I want to really start my presentation by thanking Sharon Mo, Reverend Mo, very much for welcoming me back to your church. I felt comfortable here last time, and I feel comfortable being with you and the congregation and visitors, of course, once again. I also want to thank my friend, Bert Sachs, for having kept good contact with me during the time since I was here last. And I admire Bert Sachs's courage. He was just fined $10,000. Why? Because in 1997 he dared to take medicines to Iraq. And medicines are part of the Geneva Convention's right of any people. So what has he done wrong? And I want to thank also Jerry Haynes and her husband. I think she's not here, but her husband is here. And I want to thank you for your encouragement that I receive. And I tell you, Reverend Mo said, well, to receive encouragement from me, I think I receive as much encouragement from you because there's another world out there. And when you say what I say, then you hear sometimes very ugly words. I received a message not too long ago that said, if Saddam Hussein still has weapons of mass destruction, he hoped that it would be used first and foremost against my family and I. Well, these are messages that I don't like to hear. And in an environment like the one that Reverend Mo has made possible, I feel comfortable. And so I want to thank you very much also for having come tonight. Beautiful summer evening, but you are inside. And I take this as a sign that you want to encourage me also. And for this, I'm grateful. When I was here last time, in November last year, almost a year ago, the discussion, of course, was about suffering of innocent people in Iraq. But it was against the backdrop of something very painful that has happened in America, and that was the 9th of September. And there was a wave of sympathy coming towards America from overseas. Europe, the Middle East, the globe felt, all honest people felt, that one had to show sympathy and understanding and support in what you and your government was trying to do. And that is to declare a battle, a fierce battle, not necessarily a physical battle, but a battle of some sorts against those who were capable to perform such a carnage as we have seen on the 11th of September. So that was the atmosphere at that time. And I'm very sad that now, 10 months later, Everything has changed so dramatically. War clouds are there, serious war clouds, but they are over the skies of Washington, not elsewhere, the war clouds. And at the same time, and that is right, the quest to get at the perpetrators, at the terrorists, and bring them to justice continues. But what we see internationally is a frightening mix-up, a confusion, not a misunderstanding, a confusion between the fight on terrorism and an unacceptable, at least to me, and I'm sure to you also, unacceptable agenda for power and for hegemony and for domination. And what I find amazing is in all these volumes of articles that one reads and sees every day in the newspapers in this country, on the television, what we really want to do, and which will have the longest lasting effect and is a contribution towards peace, the fight against terrorism as against a fight against terrorists. I think there's a distinction. Because when we fight terrorism, we begin to look at the causes for this unfortunate phenomenon in modern life called terrorism. We are concerned then with poverty. We are concerned with dignity. We are concerned with equality. And when you start looking at these aspects, I think then you make the first, in my view, significant step towards eliminating terrorism. If you don't do that, and you only fight symptoms, which you have to fight also, we will never have a more peaceful world. So this coalition I talked about that existed last September is gone. And we have to be clear-minded here. It doesn't exist anymore. The international community is baffled. And the superpower called the United States is becoming increasingly lonely, isolated. And there's much evidence to this effect. The closest ally is the United Kingdom, but 150 out of the roughly 600 members of the House of Commons have given their name to a petition warning Prime Minister Blair to extend support to the call for war coming out of Washington. A former field marshal, British field marshal, just a few days ago said, what is being planned amounts to putting petrol rather than water on the situation in the Middle East. And a special operations chief, also British, a British General Rose, said the other day, going to war with Iraq is madness. Now, this comes out of the country that is the closest ally of Washington in this idea of fighting a war. Germany has warned the US, and I think my country, we haven't forgotten what you did to us after we lost, and rightly so, lost the Second World War. You have been kind to us. I said this afternoon, I remember as a child, I was 6 years of age, when the packages from America arrived, the care packages, that contained not only necessary things, but wonderful things for us children, toys that we hadn't seen, chocolate. We remember America, and we are grateful to this. But this Germany of the year 2002 has said to the US, we do not want to participate in adventures, meaning we are not going to be a partner in the war against Iraq. France warned the US and saying, a war against Iraq only through the United Nations Security Council. And they know they will never get a mandate out of the UN Security Council. Russia also doesn't want a military solution. And in the Middle East, the voices are strong, in fact, very strong. King Abdullah, on his way to Washington, stopped over in London a week ago. His words, not mine. In a very colloquial way, he addressed the press and said, "Those people in Washington, you don't get it. You can talk until you're blue in your face. They are not getting it." Now, that's from a king, a rather straightforward, clear language. So the Arab voice is there. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Dr. Amir Moussa, has many times warned that a war against Iraq will only intensify the suffering and the flames that already exist in the Middle East. Against this, we have had something which I think is a natural part of a democratic process. I think it was commendable that Senator Biden, a Democrat from Delaware, invited as the chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, his committee to meet with witnesses to talk about Iraq, to talk about the threat, to talk about the options, to talk about the day after Iraq has been invaded. Well, I think all of that one has to welcome, that there is a willingness to have a dialogue on this issue in the House that represents a democratic system, and that is the U.S. Congress. The problem was, and I'm not really, please accept for me, I'm not saying this because I wasn't invited, despite attempts by a large number of people who asked through Senator Feingold and others to invite me to Washington. Well, I wasn't. Doesn't matter. There are other good people. There are many people, including here in this very church hall, who could have been called to testify because they have been there. They have been in Iraq. They have seen with their own eyes what a wrong policy, the policy of sanctions, is doing against a people who have done nothing wrong. So they were not invited. What is frightening is that the people who were invited are all of the same ilk. They're all the same kind of people. Let me just run down without mentioning names. I think that wouldn't be so correct. But you know some of the people I refer to. But you have the director, the former director of the task force in Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War in 1990. You have an Iraqi defector who was until the mid-90s in Iraq and now pretends to be someone who has left behind all the evil things, even though if he says what Iraq is, then he should be first put behind bars, and when he has served out his sentence, then he can talk about Iraq. But at this point, to talk about Iraq, in which he himself participated, I think is to me not very convincing. His American professor, where he got his PhD, said, "I have created a monster." That comes from a professor about a witness in Washington. There's another professor of strategic studies whom Amnesty International recently accused of having presented a report calling for excessive force against Palestinians. He was called. Then there was a former UN disarmament chief. On the 38th floor in New York, where the Secretary General has his office, he is called the biggest liar the UN ever had. Not a very commendable reference to somebody who's called before a U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Then you have two very prominent former government officials. One was a former Secretary of Defense in Operation Desert Storm in 1991, and the other one was a national security advisor in the Clinton administration, hardly people who can be considered as unbiased in this discussion. And moreover, most of these people have never been in Iraq, or if they have, not for many years. So this leads to the obvious. It leads to getting as a committee that which you wanted to hear in the first place. And when you read the congressional record on this two-day meeting, 31st of July and the 1st of August, just a week ago, your worst fears are confirmed, I'm afraid. It's a document which could have been written without the hearings. One has the feeling the conclusions could have been prepared before the hearings started. Iraq is portrayed there as having once again created nuclear weapons. Iraq is portrayed as having loaded Antrax onto missiles, which is a direct and clear expression of dishonesty, because I happen to have been involved, or I was in Iraq at the time, when a Swiss, a French, and an American laboratory did testing whether or not Antrax had been spiked onto missiles, and the result was that the Swiss and the French laboratories said there was no evidence, and the American laboratory said, yes, there was evidence. So it wasn't a clear case and doesn't allow the statement that was made in the hearings that Iraq had loaded Antrax onto missiles. The hearings also leave no one in doubt that Iraq has trained terrorists around the world. There's no evidence to this, but the statement is made. What I know a little bit more clearly from my visits, from my discussions, also from my visits in northern Iraq, where Baghdad is not in control, where the Kurds are in control of their own local districts, and the congressional hearing says that al-Qaeda terrorists are roaming freely in Baghdad. Now, that is an outrageous statement. There are some al-Qaeda escapees from Afghanistan. They managed to run across Iran into northern Iraq outside of the control of Baghdad. There are a handful of these people. Only 3 weeks ago, I was across the line of control in northern Iraq. I spoke to Kurdish leaders there. They said to me, apart from a handful of these al-Qaeda individuals, there is no link to al-Qaeda. But these individuals are cooperating with a small, local, Kurdish fundamentalist group that has nothing to do with Baghdad. And yet the impression in the congressional hearings is that Baghdad is full of terrorists from the al-Qaeda group. Another statement that one sees that comes out of these hearings is that Iraq is still the word is the most effective military power in the Middle East. I think one has to laugh about this. Thank you. I'm very glad that you are laughing. Because if there's a country today, I dare to say, in the Middle East, that is weaker than the rest, it is Iraq, militarily speaking. We know Saudi Arabia has a budget crisis because it has overextended itself in buying arms. Not to speak of Israel, that has a large arsenal of all the kinds of weapons that Iraq may have dreamt about at one point, but today, in my view, doesn't own anymore. So the conclusions that the committee came to are very straightforward. The threat exists. The response that there should be is an attack. The only worry, it's very interesting, it's not about international law or what the outside world may think about an attack. The only worry that comes really through in these records is how much does it cost? And do we have the military capacity to fight such a war if we go it alone? And maybe most frightening, let us assume there is an attack which isn't justifiable on the basis of the evidence that we have. I will speak about that a little bit later, a bit more. But there is no vision about the day after, when there is a successful military intervention. What do you put then into Baghdad? whom do you put into Baghdad? The meetings with the Iraqi national opposition that are taking place or have taken place a few days ago in Washington. I think I'm not unfair in interpreting the U.S. administration as feeling very uncomfortable with these groups, because they don't see in among these anyone who really is the obvious leader in a democratic Iraq of tomorrow. So there is no vision for that day after. And I really cannot understand that a country, an administration that exists in the United States of America has totally forgotten that the United Nations was created by wise Americans to a large extent. It was not accidental that the United Nations Charter was signed in San Francisco in 1945. The drafting of that charter, which was largely the work of American brains. I cannot believe that all that is forgotten. And in the hearings, in these congressional hearings, there were no references to the United Nations as a vehicle for peaceful conflict resolution or a reference to international law. How can, and please forgive me if I sound now hostile here, how can a president who goes on Sunday to church be a promoter of war on Monday of the kind that we see right now? I cannot understand that. So the conclusions after these 2 days of hearings to which the chairman of this committee comes to, and I quote, is we had a thoroughly balanced discussion of the problems. Well, I'm glad you are laughing. I want to laugh also. But it's a question of whether or not the thrust of the advice is to go ahead and hit, or whether the advice is halt, think, and reconsider. All these efforts that we have seen particularly since the 11th of September, to implicate, to link Iraq to terrorism, to link Iraq to anthrax, to link Iraq to Al-Qaeda, have collapsed like a house of cards. There is no evidence. There is simply no evidence. The anthrax discussion almost became embarrassing, because instead of pointing internationally, it is pointing more and more domestically as an issue. And therefore, silence prevails now in terms of linking Iraq to anthrax. Maybe immodestly, I want to make a bold statement here. What Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld has offered to you and has offered to us internationally as evidence lacks any evidence. Instead, a person who is absolutely not qualified to talk about disarmament issues, myself, suddenly feel that I can say something on that issue. Why? During this last visit to Baghdad, I asked the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Dr. Tariq Aziz, to allow me, I was with the official German television in Iraq, to go and see two sites that were alleged by U.S. intelligence, by New York Times, by the Washington Post, to have resumed the production of biological and chemical agents. Well, to my surprise, the Deputy Prime Minister agreed to this. So it was my choice where I wanted to go. And the first site that I chose was a site where I had been when I was in office in 1999. It was a foot and mouth disease vaccine production facility. That factory or that center had been totally destroyed by the disarmament group of the United Nations. I saw that in 1999. Yet, I read in the papers in 2001 and this year that they were producing again. Well, you don't have to be a disarmament expert to see that there is no possibility to do anything to produce a biological agent. It was a totally destroyed facility. The second one to which I went was in the Western Desert. It said in the paper, and it was confirmed by an official, probably, it said government official, U.S. government official, that this facility, satellite imagery had disclosed that it was again producing chemical agents. When we went there, we saw the unit that allegedly was producing this. It was a castor bean oil extraction facility that normally makes brake fluids. But the waste product, the byproduct is called ricin, risin, R-I-C-I-N, risin, which is used indeed for making chemical agents for weapons of mass destruction. Well, the facility was destroyed. There was no sign that it could produce. The pipes were hanging down, it was rusting, there was nothing. Must I really be a disarmament expert to come to the conclusion that they have nothing? I don't think so. We have the footage. It is shown now in Europe. And I will try by hook and by crook. I don't have the copyrights, but I will try to make sure that it reaches also United States public media so that one can see. Because it's so important. Because it will help to destroy this wall of disinformation that is surrounding you. Now, this is not demagogy when I say that. That's simply a fact. If I were living in this country, I live in Bremerton, and I look at the Bremerton Sun. Why do I know about this? Because my wife happens to be from that area. And then I read something, I would not be able to judge whether what I'm reading is correct or not. And when you then have this kind of insight, I think you become quite worried. Now, I owe you, I think, an answer to the question, why is there this ringing of the war drums? Why are we going through this period Reverend Moore has talked about? I think we are going through that for two reasons. The first one is an immense political liability that the U.S. Congress and the U.S. administration has loaded on their shoulder in October 1998, because that was the month during which the U.S. Congress passed the Iraq Liberation Act. The Iraq Liberation Act has several references to declared U.S. policy to remove the regime in Baghdad. Now, in the Clinton days, this was taken a little bit more relaxed, and containment was in a way the answer. But since January 2001, it has taken on a different meaning. I think the present government means business in implementing the Iraq Liberation Act. So that's, I think, one factor in this whole thing. And the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings confirm that. There are several references to that very fact. But there's a second reason. And the second reason is that the political landscape, ladies and gentlemen, in the Middle East is quickly changing. What a year ago was a much different picture, today is such that there's hardly a government or the public in the Middle East that is willing to condone or to continue to condone the presence of foreign troops on their soil. For example, the most dramatic example, which you have, I'm sure, noticed, is that suddenly Saudi Arabia, someone even has talked about the RAND Corporation briefing. You have seen the Ministry of Defense, Department of Defense, said, this is our new enemy. That goes very far. But the fact is, the Saudis have given notice that there is not going to be Saudi Arabian soil to be used in an attack against Iraq. This is why U.S. military facilities are gradually being shifted into the neighboring Qatar to accommodate and be a second best staging area for the war that is being planned. So with a Middle East that no longer supports a military action or confrontation with Iraq, I think there is a totally different picture that presents itself. The Beirut summit, there was a summit of the 22, there are 22 Arab governments that make up the so-called Arab League. They met in March of this year. At the end of their two-day meeting in Beirut, in Lebanon, they issued a statement, and in that statement it said, among other things, we do not want a military confrontation against our brotherly country, Iraq. Our brotherly country. That included Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So when the U.S. government says we must fight that war also to protect the neighbors of Iraq against the threat that Iraq constitutes, then some of the neighbors now say, who told you that we feel there is a threat? You know, so it is perceived as if they would feel it is a threat. They don't feel that way. They're tired. They don't want a war against another country in their region. The fire is already burning hard enough on the western edges of the Middle East. The Secretary General of the Arab League I mentioned, he has toured the countries. He has warned the U.S. and the U.N. not to start experimenting in the Middle East. And there is a great process, slow as it is, but there is a great process of normalization between former adversaries. The Saudi Arabians and the Iraqis have recently opened their borders again. When I was in Baghdad, Saudi Arabian businessmen were displaying their goods. There's a trade between the two countries. Iran and Iraq, it's correct, they have not yet signed a peace treaty, but they have diplomatic relations. They are exchanging the remains of their fallen soldiers and exchanging also prisoners of war at an accelerated speed. And there is an excellent relationship that in 1 year has developed between, whether we like Syria or not, but between Syria and Iraq. And there's even a small signal of a peace process between Kuwait and Iraq. Iraq has agreed to return to Kuwait the archives, the national archives, which they stole, if you wish, if they expatriated in the Gulf War. So, in other words, it is not wrong to say that the U.S. military presence in the Middle East is on notice. And we can only understand when we know that why there is a greater determination now in Washington to end the chapter, to finish the chapter, and preferably through a military confrontation. So this may explain why containment as a policy is dead. One can forget about this. Today, the policy is to move quickly from containment to occupation. And the question again, why is that? Why is that so? Well, some people talk about a family feud between the Hussein family and the Bush family. I think that's too primitive. A reason, finishing the 1991 chapter when the U.S. decided not to go the last 80 kilometers or so towards Baghdad is another reason that we hear. Given the economic problems that are suddenly coming up and other domestic issues, diverting attention from local issues possible, I think it is the same old three-letter word that gives the real reason. I remind you, maybe I said it last November, but it was Henry Kissinger who said, oil is much too important a commodity to be left in the hands of the Arabs. And I want to read to you what last week in the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations, I have the record, what was said on that subject by Senator Lugar. Senator Lugar said, in addition to identifying the political leadership and the coalition and building democracy, we are going to run the oil business. We are going to run it well. We are going to make money. And it's going back to help pay for the rehabilitation of Iraq because there is money there. Now, I think that is just another way of saying it as compared to what Mr. Kissinger said. And I believe that this is a fairly honest statement of the motives of some quarters of the U.S. powerhouse, if one can say that. So one reason why I got fairly early on into difficulty with your government and the British government was related to this, because I said Iraq, United States, Britain don't fight that political battle on the back of innocent people. And that is what is continuing to happen. This is, one can point the finger at Iraq, and one can point the finger at the US and the UK. And in doing so, I'm the last one, even though I'm accused sometimes, in pretty straightforward terms, that I'm a naive fool in the pocket of Baghdad, that I'm paid by Baghdad. Someone in the Donahue show, where we had a discussion last week out of Chicago, said, this man is crossing the boundary from sane assessment to paranoid fantasy. These were the words. Well, I don't mind. My skin is getting by the week thicker. I'm becoming an elephant in a way. it's okay. It's all right. I just wanted to say that to make sure that you realize that I fully am aware and I detest the repression that is exercised by the government of Iraq against its own people. But I'm proud to tell you also that in October of the year 2000, half a year after I resigned, I returned to Iraq and I spoke in the Iraq National Assembly. And here was in front of me a huge portrait of Saddam Hussein, and there were 350 members of the National Assembly. And I criticized the human rights record of Iraq. I criticized the fact that there was a harsh judicial system. I criticized the fact that they were not free to speak, that they were not free to travel. So it's not that I have protected Iraq and only criticize. Who am I? I'm one small fish in this huge tank of controversy with Iraq. But it's one thing to recognize that Iraq has seen a terrible chapter in its history of lawlessness. But in saying that, one should not forget that we, internationally, in 12 years of economic sanctions, have played a major role in destroying a nation. I think we must accept responsibility for that, and also for the fact that we have impoverished people who live in a country which was proud to have a progressive medical, educational, and social system, even in the time when they had this dictator. That was before sanctions. Today, just to give you a very few, but remind ourselves of some of the frightful realities that exist in that country. 55% of Iraqis live below the poverty level. And if they had to buy the food basket, which Saddam Hussein hands out once a month, if they had to buy that food basket with their own resources, then over 90% of the Iraqis would be below the poverty line. Are you surprised that in these many years of a totally unnatural life, that the incidence of mental disorder among adults, among children, has risen enormously? We have statistics. One statistic is from 0 age to 6, under 1 year, up to 6 years. The incidence of mental disease, according to the World Health Organization, from reported cases, there may be many others, is from 200,000 in 1990 to 520,000 in 1999, a steep increase, not surprising. The average salaries, I may have mentioned it last year, but it's such a stark example. I know a home economics professor, an Iraqi in Iraq, who was trained, got her PhD in this country. When she came back 35 or so years ago, 40 years ago, as a young lecturer, she earned over $400 a month. Today, after so many years of 40 plus years of teaching experience in Baghdad, she earns 19,000 Iraqi dinar, which is under $10. So it's a hopeless story for everybody, particularly for the middle class. Children are dying that should live, that have a right to live, just like any child in Europe or in America. And UNICEF reports that the increase in the mortality of children under five has been 160%. And if you look at the publication that UNICEF issued in December of the year 2001, not long ago, you will see that out of the 188 countries that were surveyed by UNICEF, 188 countries, Iraq is the 188th country. And Iraq is a rich country. Iraq would never have reached that low level outside of a sanction regime. So I can go on, there is so much more that, but I want to pick out two more statistics. One is, what is happening to literacy? In 1987, Iraq received an international prize for having brought down illiteracy to 20%. Today, already it has gone up to 49% according to UNESCO. 49%. And who are the first victims? I don't think you'll be surprised if I tell you women, girls. The girl is the one that doesn't go to school. The brother can just barely, they can afford to send him to school. But the girl doesn't. I did filming with a Swiss television crew in September 2001 in Iraq. We went to a school. We picked out a girl and traced her through her day to show what kind of life she was leading. In the process, we got the following statistic. In 1998, that school had 250 boys and girls. 50 were girls. A year later, there were 20 girls. And when we did the filming, there were 8 girls left. That's the story. That is in a country that was almost fully literate just a decade earlier. And it doesn't look good in terms of what is available to the education system. They need 68 million textbooks. They don't have. If you go into the average school and you take a book, you have to hold it really well in your hands, otherwise it will fall on the ground because it's no longer bound together. It's used over and over and over again. That's at the primary school level. At the university level, there's a U.S. Postal Administration law that says no printed material can be sent to Iraq. So a textbook for medicine and medical students, against the law. You are not allowed to send that. Therefore, they have nothing. They have very little because many other countries follow the same principle. And here is the program for which I was responsible, the so-called Oil for Food program. In the initial years, it had at its disposal, I'm simplifying for sake of time, it had at its disposal the equivalent, believe that, of $113 per person per year to meet all the requirements of life. Food, medicine, electricity, water, sanitation, agriculture, and education. $113, that was all. If we had more time, I could give you a 2-hour outline of the clear punishment-oriented approach that this organization to which I gave my professional life, 32 long years I was there, is pursuing. It's a punishment approach, and that is punishing the wrong party. That is the problem. I think I will just go to a few concluding remarks and not talk too much. Maybe you have questions about smart sanctions that were introduced earlier this year that are not smart at all, that will simply prolong the suffering of the people. But I'm in a church, so in a church I can quote the Bible. And what came to my mind in preparing for this is Luke, who said, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they are doing." And I think this is what I feel. If they would know what they are doing in the Security Council, in the State Department, in their cushy offices in Europe and North America, I hope they couldn't close their eyes at night because their conscience would bother them. So what should they do? I'm often asked that by the press. What should they do? Here is a confirmed evil leader in whom one cannot trust. So what should one do? What is the alternative to a war? Well, I would say a precondition to any alternative is that the current government in Washington ends its unilateralism. Total isolation is what we see coming out of Washington, not just related to Iraq. You know that. You have seen the discussion about the UN Criminal Court. You have heard about the refusal by the administration to sign the Biological Weapons Convention. You have seen the resistance to sign the Convention on Torture. You have endless other examples of where there is a refusal to sign even such conventions. Here, the women must be upset and outraged that the government is refusing to sign the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the so-called CEDAW Convention, or the Convention on the Rights of the Child. CEDAW, the Women's Convention, there are two governments that have not signed that, and that is Libya and the United States. Now, I think the message here is quite clear. So I would say the unilateralism must end. America must again, or the government, not America. I'm doing a big mistake if I say America. There is another, a totally different America than the one that we see in Washington. When I travel, I see an America that is alert, that is well informed, that is outraged that there is such an approach, and therefore it's unfair to say America. One has to say the government, the administration, must come out of its snail house and become international minded again. And I would try in really now concluding before you start throwing, because it's warm in here, throwing at me metaphysically maybe tomatoes. I don't want you to do that. I want to say the U.S. must support a dialogue at different levels. I have not changed my mind on this. The dialogue at the level of the U.N. Security Council, give the Secretary General a chance. Don't muzzle him. Don't hold him on a leash that is so short. And unfortunately, he's kept at a short leash, as we have seen in the talks in Vienna in early July between Iraq and the Secretary General. Give at the Middle East level, give dialogue among the Arab countries a chance. The Beirut summit I mentioned earlier was a tremendously important basis on which one can build confidence-building measures. And then give also that chance for a dialogue. Instead of preparing now, and there is intelligence that suggests, I hope it's wrong, that in northern Iraq, special Delta forces and Navy SEALs are at work to create airports and whatever as staging areas like the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. I hope that is somebody's fiction. But if it's true, I hope it will not proceed. The dialogue between the Kurds and Baghdad exists, strengthen it, be positive, and rather than discourage that people who had opposing views talk to each other. And at the same time, what we want, what I as a European individual want to see, is that we build together a strong coalition in the fight against terrorism, but not a coalition in the for a war against Iraq or any other country. I want to say at the very end, I want to try to explain why there is U.S. opposition to this dialogue. I think the U.S. administration is genuinely worried that if the inspectors go back into Iraq and find that there is nothing, that everything that they have now given us as so-called evidence is fiction, then the entire policy towards the Middle East has collapsed. And I think there is a genuine fear that this is so. Now, why would then this dictator in Baghdad not agree to the arms inspectors to come back? Well, I can tell you, the foreign minister, just after he came back from Vienna to Baghdad, I was in Baghdad. And he said, we want the inspectors to come back, but we don't want to have a group of inspectors come back into Iraq that are then once again being misused by Western intelligence agencies that come in, look where we have our facilities, then they create an incident, and they're leaving us and then have a wonderful reason to attack us. So we want conditions. We want a guarantee from the UN Secretary General that UN arms inspectors will not be misused for intelligence gathering operation. That makes to me pretty good sense, I must say. So my last sentence is public pressure. I have great difficulty to understand as a visitor why there is this disconnect between community groups across your big and wonderful country. I was a foreign student here. I like America. Critical voices about US policy doesn't make us anti-American at all. If that were so, there would be many American anti-Americans. Doesn't make sense. By definition, one cannot be as an American anti-American. But I would say I cannot understand that disconnect. Why is it that there are groups in every community that have strong voices, that are repositories of honesty? Why they do not penetrate into mainstream media or have a real influence on political decision-making in Washington? So I want to make a pitch, a big pitch, for converting that disconnect into a powerful connect. And I think all of us in this room and outside, that's what we owe to peace. And I want to end with a quote from a woman I respect enormously, Eleanor Roosevelt. I quoted her already. She wrote in the late 40s something which I think we all like. When, she said, will our conscience grow so tender that we will seek to prevent suffering rather than avenge it? Thank you.